Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, October 28th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we learn about a shot heard round the world, a political document that changed the course of human history, and what it means to say that all of us, yes, all of us, are created equal. We explore the American Revolution. It's a 12-part documentary series by the PBS Ken Burns team. We'll hear from two of the filmmakers. But first, we will ask our own state historian about what South Dakotans might watch for in the film and the complex work of patriotism today. Then, later in the hour, the Teacher Talk educators with a message for all who work in our public schools. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are spending this hour talking about American revolutionary history. So first, we turn to our very own state historian. Dr. Ben Jones is also an American historian and director of the South Dakota State Historical Society. Plus, he is chairing the committee to plan the United States 250th celebration here at home. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. We are gearing up to watch The American Revolution, which is a 12-part series produced by Ken Burns and his team. And we're going to hear from the producers a little bit later in this hour. But I wanted to start with you because you are a South Dakota state historian. And I thought I would ask you, overall, what are some of the things that South Dakota viewers might be particularly tuned into as we watch the complete history in 12 hours at least of the American Revolution? What comes to mind for you first?
Well, South Dakota viewers are Americans, and certainly the Declaration of Independence is the founding document of the country, and the ideals and principles that are in the Declaration is something that impact us all in various ways and inspire and lead and organize and drive us crazy from time to time. So I think I'm interested in how Ken Burns' special explains that, the crafting of the Declaration of Independence, the politics of getting it ratified through the Continental Congress. I'm sure it wasn't an easy lift. And the editing that goes on in the summer of 1776, all while shots have been fired and now the war has started and the king has declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. And it's quite a brew of events that's occurring as that's being written. So I think that that is important to kind of understand that the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, these documents aren't just kind of something that pop up in a Google search. They were produced through a lot of intellectual, hard labor, sweat, political disagreements, backroom shenanigans, perhaps, certainly, and in the end, ratified by the entire Continental Congress, and in the case of the Constitution, 1781, unanimously ratified by all the states.
Yeah. And it is, how important is the Declaration as a political document?
I don't think you can overstate it. It inspires people all over the world. You know, Ho Chi Minh in 1945 is pulling out Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration and reading it to his American advisors as the Japanese are leaving town. Occupied Vietnam, right? And now he's no Jeffersonian Democrat, Ho Chi Minh, but the fact that he knows it and he's conversant in it enough, he's a very well-educated man, and to be able to kind of use that as either a cynical propaganda ploy, but or maybe in some cases a sincere desire to say, see, we can be independent too, and the United States should help us in that. So it's something that reverberates around the country to this day. And I remember sitting in my office in Afghanistan working with a translator to translate the Declaration of Independence into the local language because it wasn't on Wikipedia. And I thought, let's do this. And he jumped into it, the translator did. So people recognize what the power behind that and the notions behind it and the sense that it brings to politics and to just everyday life is very important, very palpable.
That all men are created equal.
Right.
That all people are created equal is a revolutionary idea.
Well, what's revolutionary about it is it's an ancient idea, but the fact that the United States and these gentlemen in 1776 are putting it as the founding idea to a government, it's the first time that happens. Mm. And so some folks get a little bent out of shape by saying that the United States is an exceptional nation. I think it is because of that very thing. Declaration of Independence is something that states very clearly that we are all created equal, and that guiding goal is something to be conserved and fought for.
The pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. What did they mean then? Help us understand the intent of those words.
There's a great book about this a couple of years ago by Jeffrey Rosen, who's the director of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. He tells a story about how in a COVID lockdown in Philadelphia and Washington, he decided that he was going to do a lot of deep reading and think about that very thing. What did they mean by the pursuit of happiness? And he found them, Franklin and Jefferson and so forth, realizing that to be happy, one needs to be in self-control. One needs to govern oneself. And so that the role of any national government, and why they were saying the king had lost his moral authority in the colonies, was because he himself was not playing by the rules, and there are rules that pertain to everybody. And even the English king at the time had agreed to be constrained within the constitutional traditions of the British law and parliamentary format and so forth, and that he was outside the bounds of that. Likewise, an individual needs to be able to govern themselves. And if you can govern yourself, then you can be happy. And so they were reaching back.
What do you mean, govern yourself? Like the pursuit of self-improvement?
In some ways.
Morality, law-abidingness,
right.
Joy? What do you mean?
Just being able to, mind your own passions. Being able to use your curiosity in the way that's most productive. Being able to spend your time in the way that's most productive. Being able to be looking out for your neighbor and so forth. Being a part of a community. That's part of the pursuit of happiness. And denying yourself, things that might be go too far, whether it's weight loss or getting time in the gym but certainly spending too much money, growing broke, any kind of personal habits you might have that would lead to self-destruction. They knew that very well. I mean, there's alcohol and drugs and all manner of things that still are signs of human failing. They were aware of that, and they knew that if a government is going to perform its role of being a government that allows humans to flourish, then the humans themselves, the people, have to be able to master their own appetites.
You have a responsibility to flourish.
Yeah. Yes, that's a good way to put it.
And did they agree on what flourishing meant? We should be physically fit. We should be mentally fit. We should be literate.
Yeah.
We should be, did they agree on that, or did they have different ideas of that?
In general, they probably had similar ideas. I think.
Is this Franklin?
Franklin
who
and Jefferson
this to the
and John
table,
Adams.
Or do they all?
They all do. They all read the ancients. They read Cicero. Mm-hmm. They understood the notions of
Aristotle. And was the king stopping them from doing that?
The king
or were they pointing out that the king wasn't doing that?
I don't know that they
knew. Why'd they put that in the Declaration? That wasn't part of their cry for independence. That was just saying, this is what we should.
Yeah. Well, if the government's responsibility is to provide a place where people can have their life and pursue their happiness and have their liberties, then the king was not doing that. The king was failing in that.
What is the just use of political authority?
What is the just use of political authority? That is the crux of the matter. I think if the king had, well, certainly in the minds of the American colonists, and John Adams remarks upon this, that the Revolutionary War wasn't on the battlefields, although it was, but the first Revolutionary War is a war about moral authority in the minds of the colonists, the minds of the American people in the 1760s and 1770s. When the king issues a writ in 1765 that really threatens trial by jury, that begins a couple of issues that in Boston and in Massachusetts, people start, no, he doesn't have the authority to do that. And that begins kind of this long, slow burning fuse of one thing after another that's inherently threatening to the rights of the colonists. And that because that continues time after time, tax after unrepresentative tax, that the king's moral authority is diminished incredibly. And then, of course, when he hires Hessians, soldiers from Germany to come over and establish security again, that's just another insult. And a sign that the king has lost his moral authority.
What is the hard work of patriotism today?
Listening. I think that's very hard. People like to be as I think I've heard the term keyboard warriors, just type out a thought on social media that tends to confuse and inflame rather than provide light and clarity and illumination. That's tough to do. But also understanding where the red lines are, whatever your personal red line might be, but understanding what is the red line actually in statute and what the law says. And I think part of not being a preemptive keyboard warrior is also reading around the room, not only reading one media source, but reading several and try to get to the nub of the deal and do your own research.
I would add, do your own thinking.
And yes, and that's the...
Because it's become almost so easy right now to do cheap research.
Right.
And the hard thing might be to sit and think about what you consider the hard work of patriotism to be right now.
I agree. I try in this job as a director of the State Historical Society and also as chair of the America 250 Commission for South Dakota to encourage South Dakotans and everybody who visits our museum, reads one of our books, to do their own thinking. It's the theme of my podcast, History 605, and we've started out that way, and we invite people on and walk through their thinking about why they wrote the book that they did.
Yeah. That's Dr. Ben Jones. He is state historian and director of the South Dakota State Historical Society. Up next, we talk to the co-directors of the new American Revolution documentary series by Ken Burns. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new documentary from filmmakers Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, and David Schmidt explores one of our nation's defining chapters, the American Revolution. The new documentary goes beyond battles and founding fathers to uncover the stories of ordinary people whose courage and conviction shaped a new nation. Filmmakers Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt join me on Zoom to talk about the making of the American Revolution, the challenges of bringing complex history to life on screen, and what lessons the past still holds for the present. I sat down, I was telling David before we hit record, I sat down before watching this series and asked myself what I already know about the American Revolution and where I thought I learned that from school to Schoolhouse Rock to books that I had read before I began. And then I began watching, and one of the first things I noticed in the film was the filmmaking challenges that you had, the opportunities, because America is a beautiful country. But immediately I was wondering how you got the footage, because that's not how the towns look today. So much has changed geographically and in our urban centers. With our weather, everything has shifted. So let's talk about filmmaking first, if we can. And Sarah, maybe you want to begin with some of the challenges of filming a revolution.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this a lot, so David is probably sick of me saying that. I think what initially seemed really daunting and a reason maybe not to make the film ended up being such an enormously gratifying artistic and filmmaking opportunity. We really got to think about creative and new ways to film both the extreme majesty and amazing variety of the North American landscape, particularly along the Eastern Seaboard, where the 13 colonies where the revolution was fought are, to think about ways to shoot those in a timeless way that they might evoke something of the 18th century or the ruins, you know, Fort Ticonderoga, Crown Point, Saratoga, the battlefields at Lexington and Concord, Cowpens, and then the amazing living history museums, Colonial Williamsburg, among the, you know, Sturbridge Village. Some of the Native nations have incredible living history museums, the longhouses. So to try to bring to life what people might have looked at, fields they might have crossed, rivers they might have traveled, that was, and then to film those in a way that is both beautiful, a little bit authentic, and impressionistic, right? We didn't want to be distracted by the 21st century reenactors, their faces. Who are they? Where are they? Is that really the XYZ that we're talking about? So it became, do we film them through glass? Do we have a smoke? Are we far away and high up? Are we very, very close? And, you know, we shot over 8 years on this project, really over 5 years all the time, and got better as we went, really upped our game as we went. And I think hopefully the final product is, you know, visually beautiful and arresting and sustains a viewer for the 12 hours.
Yeah. And David, you are chasing eclipses and snowstorms and rain and sunshine and ocean or lake, you know, weather over the lake. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about some of the just having to put yourself in the right place at the right time with the benefit of modern weather forecasting.
Yeah. Even with the benefit of modern weather forecasting, you know, we had to cancel shoots because of weather. We had to change our plans as we went. You know, the eclipse itself, there's an eclipse in 1778. We wanted to tell that story. So we went out and filmed the eclipse of 2024. And we had a plan to film in a certain part of New York State, but the weather wasn't cooperating. So we had to scramble, and our colleagues who were on that shoot ended up driving several hours to the east. And, you know, it's a happy accident. I'm glad they did. They found an incredibly beautiful view of the ground and the sky above. Maybe they would have had a good one closer to Syracuse, New York, where they were planning to be, but I don't even know. And in terms of chasing the weather, I mean, I think we know that these last few years have had a lot less snow than happened during the revolution. It was a particularly cold decade. So we weren't inundated with snow in the way that they were, but we wanted to faithfully recreate their experiences. So we were just constantly on our weather apps trying to see when it might snow at Valley Forge or when it might snow in Morristown or up the Hudson River. It hadn't snowed for 2 years in Philadelphia, and a lot of the revolution took place obviously in Philadelphia. The Continental Congress was in session there through several winters, and even one winter the British army occupied Philadelphia. So we wanted to see that city in snow, and we got very lucky that that day came to us. But that was a scramble to get everybody out the door to be filming in four different places at once where it snowed.
Now, Sarah, I know you have to step out here, but I did want to ask you this. I was reading in the Atlantic magazine something you and David and Ken Burns published together about the experience of making this film and some of the big, heavy questions that you're asking yourself at the end about what you're willing to risk for in service of your country. What are you willing to die for? What's the role of government? What responsibilities come with the privileges of citizenship? Mm-hmm. And so before we let you step out, I'm wondering if you could just leave us with something that an answer, or are there just more questions after questions for you? How did this change you as an American?
Definitely changed me as an American to work on this project in some really profound ways. And I think for me, the film is ultimately a very patriotic story that over the last 250 years, as many things that we've not done well, as many bruises as we have, as many dark marks in our history there are, this is still the greatest experiment in a people's republic and a working democracy that I can find. I'm very, very proud to be an American. My mother's mother's family came over on the Mayflower. My father's family came in 1949 as Jewish refugees, having lost everything in the Second World War. So for me, being an American, I can hold both those identities. And I think being an active citizen, to be involved in your local community, to know your neighbor, to debate with your neighbor in the most civilized ways, to care about what happens in your local community, in your state, and in your federal government, and to try to push forward and to celebrate what it means to have and exercise your right to vote, and to have a government that was built on the notion of checks and balances, that no one person or one institution has too much power over the people. And I think the revolution is an instructive and inspiring story, and I feel extremely privileged to have worked on the film.
Yeah, it is an incredible accomplishment. It is history making in itself as a film. And David, before we get to some of those big key takeaways, I do want to go back a little bit and talk about some of the details. The soundscape, for example, is almost shockingly good. And of course, I'm keyed in as a radio person to be really listening for that. The art that you were able to find, and the writing. Mm-hmm. People were writing about their experiences in war, from John Greenwood at Valley Forge to a Quaker woman to Washington and Jefferson, Adams, Thomas Paine. As you're going through some of that archival writing, what stood out to you about the experiences that people were putting down on paper and sending in letters or tracking in their own diaries and journals?
I think one thing that I didn't realize going into making this film was how literate 18th century North America was.
Yeah.
There are obviously certain populations that didn't have as easy access to the written language or the English language as others. So there's only a few representative cases for certain pockets of the population. But there's still representative testimony to the experience they lived through. And I think that these people recognized that they were living through history. So they were willing to commit that to paper, either in the moment or after the fact. Four of the key witnesses, I would say, in our story were very young when the revolution began. One of whom is named Betsy Ambler. She was from Yorktown, Virginia. She was 10 when the war began. Joseph Plum Martin and John Greenwood are kind of rank and file Continental soldiers, in addition to other things that they did. They were both, I believe, 14 when the war began and 15 when they entered the service. And then James Fortin, who's a freeborn Black Philadelphian, was, I believe, 8 when the war began, 9 when he heard the Declaration of Independence read out loud in Philadelphia for the first time, and then 14 when he joined the Patriot cause. All of them recorded their thoughts on America and or their impressions on their experience in the revolution after the fact, which I think is a beautiful thing. We get their basically the children coming of age stories, and they came of age with their country and then would go on to live decades in the United States, shaping their country and their continent. Betsy Ambler, she's from Yorktown. Like I said, she lost her hometown in that war. Yeah. She spent a lot of the war with her family as a war refugee. I don't think we often think of the American Revolution as a story of refugees, but it really is. And she's the great example of it. She never saw a battle, but she was impacted by that war every day. In a really, truly big ways. She wrote down her experience, not in a memoir that was published, not in her diary, but in letters to her little sister, because her little sister had also experienced that, but was too young to remember what their family had lived through during the revolution. I find that so moving.
Yeah.
She wasn't trying to sell anything. She was just putting her memory on paper, sharing it with her family. And she's an incredible writer.
Yeah.
And I think so, in addition to these people being literate, my God, could they write?
And to your point, she understands the moment in history and understands what it means for the future in a way that is incredibly aware.
Yeah. And actually, we do have one letter or one or two letters of hers that are when she was 15, writing to a friend in Yorktown that are also really well written. So it's not entirely in the past for her, but it's a little bit of both with her.
You mentioned refugees, and that was one of the things that, you know, I kept noticing throughout the series that I'd say, well, of course, I had never thought about that, or I had never learned about that. But if I had taken time to think, I would have known there were camps and there were women doing the laundry. Right. And what does it look like after a battle for women to go take care of the dead, to clean things up? Where did food come from? And how did people handle refugees, looting, plundering, crimes against citizens? All these things are in there. And I don't know if we don't learn that, if I hadn't learned that in school because I was, you know, very busy learning battles and, you know, key dates and, you know, key important, you know, historical figures, that maybe I missed that. Or do we sanitize it a little bit?
I think there's a lot of things going on there. I think one thing is that basically before we have our first memory, we have some understanding of the revolution. It's in our currency. It's on our flag. It's in front of our faces at all times. So that first impression that you have of it is not going to be the story of violence or whether it's domestic or battlefield violence or refugees or anything like that, right? So there's one level of it that's just, you're going to get a sanitized version of it because it is so important to who we are as an American that you're going to know about it by the time you're five. You're going to know something.
Yeah.
So that's one level. Another is, I think, when we learn about it in maybe in school, you tend to learn about it in a U.S. history survey course. And I think the teachers are a little worried they're not going to get to the Vietnam War if they spend as much time on the revolution as it deserves.
Yeah.
So I think what we're offering you is not something that says the history that you learned was wrong.
Right.
I think the history you learned was likely true. What we're offering is just a lot more context to make that make sense and to make your country make more sense.
I don't think I went back and rethought anything other than expand my idea of what that meant, what that first shot meant and where it was and all of that. Yeah.
There also might be, you know, something of the last 250 years of telling this story that has sanitized it a bit because it is so world important and you don't want to, there might have been people whose motivation was to not sully the water with the violence of this experience. But my takeaway, at least after having worked on this for as long as I have, is the violence of the American Revolution, the sacrifice that people actually endured, the hunger, the famine, the death, the loss, only in my mind makes what they were willing to go through to bring forth the independence of the United States, the Union of the States, and the Republic, which 250 years later still stands, I think that makes that sacrifice all the more worthy of our attention.
And they're so different. Each colony is so different. They're not getting them to unify around something. They're not practicing their faith in the same way. They're not from the same places. Many times they're not speaking the same language. I found that really compelling as well. That's who we are today. And that's where we came from.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you had asked me 10 years ago when the idea of America as a melting pot began, I would have been wrong. But I would have said, you know, sometime in the 1800s, maybe around the Civil War. Absolutely not the case. There were people from all over Europe, Africa, and North America communicating with each other, living together side by side, sometimes intermarrying, sometimes trading, living together in North America, but there are also, you know, different people from Africa who spoke several different languages. There's many different Native American nations that we need to consider when we're talking about the American Revolution. And then there's also in the European population, there's a lot of German speakers. There's a lot of English speakers, of course. Then there's also people from Ireland, French Huguenots, Protestants and Catholics throughout the 13 colonies. Part of this war ends up on the Gulf Coast in surprisingly, I think a lot of people would think that the American Revolution is pretty much confined to the original 13 colonies. That's not the case. It's in Canada. It's in the Ohio River Valley. It's along the Gulf Coast. It's in the Caribbean, et cetera. But the part about on the Gulf Coast is already by 1780, 81, when the war on the Gulf Coast is really raring, there, the population there is so mixed. There's Native people, there's Black people from Africa and America, there's people who were born on all sorts of islands that now have names of the Dominican Republic or Haiti or Cuba, etc. And I just think that's so cool that all these people yeah. came together. Some of them came together to fight against the United States,
right.
but the coalition, the Patriot Coalition that won the war, is an incredibly varied group of people and Americans, just like Americans are today.
And the series is a great job at looking at those Native nations and helping us understand how land and land taking played a role in many of the Patriots' mindset. They wanted this. They wanted, and those maps that you show, and tell me a little bit about maps and some of the maps yeah. that you found, some of the maps you had to make, and how aspirational some of those maps were
yeah.
about where they were going to head to next.
I don't think it would surprise people in South Dakota to hear how integral American Indian history is to American history. But it actually does surprise people on the East Coast because it's not something that we really spend that much time with. And I grew up in Virginia, so, you know, I learned about Pocahontas, but that was basically the end of the Virginia Indian experience, which is obviously not true.
Right.
So, yes, there were aspirations for colonists to push beyond their the lines of settlement that they had in 1763. 1763, of course, is the moment when the British beat the French and gained control of all of their claims in North America. And the colonists think that this is going to give them a chance to go settle across the Appalachians in the Ohio River country, along the Great Lakes, et cetera. And the British government says, no, you can't go past this line. And that becomes a moment of contention between some of the more prominent colonists in Britain. And also later on, some of the war takes place in Indian country. In part, that's because people are interested in expanding. A large part of it also is, if you look at it from some of those Native nations' point of view, this is an opportunity to push back against that settlement. Yeah. And so it becomes a violent war for their independence and sovereignty, in addition to the war for American independence.
Yeah.
Okay, then in terms of the maps, if you look at some of the maps from 1755 or so, maps made in Britain, probably by people who had never stepped foot in North America, it looks a lot like the geography of North America. You know, some of the Great Lakes are drawn wrong and Mississippi's not quite, you know, right and all that stuff. But they have a general idea of the shape of the continent. You'll see shaded each of the different colonies, and some of their borders go forever. I think Virginia's borders, you know, the eastern borders look the same, the southern border looks the same, but there is no western border. It just goes and goes and goes past the Mississippi River even. And you'll see on these maps, underneath those shading, you'll see the words Osages, you'll see the words Cherokee, you'll see the words Chickasaw. They knew those people were there and actually occupying that land. They were just saying that, but we have claim to that and we intend to go out there eventually. But there's no white Virginian actually settled out in some of those places. Somebody had been out there, had met them, they were communicating with each other, but it was aspirational for them to actually control that and put their flag there someday.
Yeah. What are some of the things that changed for you, not only as a filmmaker, but as an American, as you did this work? How has it shifted your perspective?
I think it's made me much more connected with the people of the past. I can see a kinship. I can feel a shared kinship with them. I can imagine sort of the horror that they went through and also the possibility that they were embracing. I mean, everybody who's entering into this conflict is hoping for a better future for themselves. And this revolution might not have given them a better future, but it gave them the chance for it. I think that's really interesting and inspiring. I can't think of too many moments that really offer that to so many different types of people.
Yeah. That's Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt, co-directors of The American Revolution. The American Revolution will premiere on SDPB Sunday, November 16th. It airs for 6 consecutive nights through Friday, November 21st. It's an event. The full series will be available to stream beginning Sunday, November 16th at pbs.org and on the PBS app. After the break, we check in with our Teacher Talk educators. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today on Teacher Talk, we are reflecting on the heart of our communities, the people who serve in our schools. Teachers, counselors, custodians, education assistants, coaches, cooks, bus drivers, administrators, all the folks who show up day after day to welcome every child who walks through the school doors. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. She is in her 26th year of teaching. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. Here's our conversation. Gina, you wrote this week on Teacher Talk to all the people who serve our schools. You wrote a little bit of a love letter.
It's an ode to teachers,
yeah.
You could say, because I really do admire my colleagues. I admire the teachers who had me as a student. I think the world of teachers.
Yeah. What inspired you? Just anything in particular that people were doing, or you just sat down and thought, I gotta tell them?
I can't say there was one inspiration, but I just felt the need to, among all the other shows we've done, which have been so great, I thought, I just need to lift up teachers. I just need to encourage them. Yeah. Teaching can be very hard. We've just started the school year, hitting midterm for the, yeah, getting close to midterm. And
what's
I just
happen-
want them yeah. to know I love them.
Yeah. What's happening at midterm?
Well, you're...
Like, where are you at emotionally if you're in the classroom? If you're in the front of the classroom at midterm, where are you at emotionally?
You really are getting to know your students, and you're taking note of which ones don't turn assignments in, which ones struggle with this, which ones struggle with that, behaviorally, academically, socially.
Okay.
The puzzle is really coming together, and now you need to take action.
Okay. And how is the cell phone ban going? Because now,
I love it.
I love it. Yeah.
Oh, you have all watched the evolution of my phone journey, right? My smartphone journey as a teacher. And when our district had a universal uniform policy, everything changed. And I have colleagues at the other high schools telling me the same thing.
Mm.
And it changed because it was universal and uniform, and Jackie told that to us in an episode, that that's where you're going to get the best results. And my students have never complained to me once about it. They will occasionally, so rare though, maybe count it on one hand, take a phone out, and then I just look at them, I just tap their desk, and it gets put right away. I asked them to put it up in the pockets that hang on the wall. No complaints. But here's the best part. When they finish with something, they just sit.
Yeah.
And it's not a sit. It's not that I'm glad they're not running around. That doesn't happen with teenagers. They just sit and they're still and they're in their thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really beautiful thing to see.
Yeah.
And if that's not the case, they're chatting with each other. Also a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah. Jackie Wilbur, are you surprised at that result?
Yes and no. I mean, I think I wouldn't have been surprised whatever Gina told me. I feel like that's
isn't that
the,
true?
You know what I mean?
Nothing surprises us.
I think that's a good attitude to have when it comes to being an educator, is just like be ready for any and all. But I can attest to what Gina is saying. We had her teacher pathway students along with the other three high schools. So all four Sioux Falls School District teacher pathway student groups of students were on campus yesterday, and they were so wonderful to be around. They had a really great attitude. They were really what's the word I'm looking for? I feel like, Gina, your students were both energized and relaxed simultaneously.
Yes.
They were engaged, they were participating, they were involved, but it was not in a chaotic or disorganized way. Everyone was very comfortable being themselves and being around each other. And I actually wasn't thinking about if I saw phones or not, because I was a little bit more logistically thinking, you know, there was stuff that we were doing on our side of the whole event. But now that you say that, I don't know that I saw many phones out at all.
I was watching for it, and it got me choked up. It almost brought me to tears. There were no phones. There were no phones. So the habits can go away quickly, and new habits can be developed quickly. And you're exactly right. I sense there's less anxiety.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you had pointed out in the past, Gina, was why these phones matter. And it was the social connection and the, you know, I need to be connected during an emergency or I have some anxiety. So the anxiety part is making sense to me because if nobody's looking at their phone, then it becomes less of a pressure to get your phone out because everyone else is looking at their phone. But what about the wanting to connect with a friend who's in dire straits or family members who are bringing you something from home that you forgot? That is taking care of itself, or are there other pathways for communication?
I'm sure there's been many pathways, but our students are allowed to go look at their phones at lunchtime.
Okay. Okay.
And so that takes care of some of that. But also, I've had a student say to me, can I just have my phone right here because this is going on in my life right now?
Yeah.
Yes, of course. Well, you know, we can be flexible when we need to be and when it's very legitimate.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, that was a little detour. Let's get back to the people who serve our schools, because in this blog post, Gina, you also compare these people to the Statue of Liberty. The beacon of hope of America is also exemplified in your colleagues. What a beautiful image.
And I think it all does connect, because phones were just wearing us out because we were trying to teach but also trying to deal with phones.
Yeah.
So I think it's connected, and I wanted to encourage teachers and say, I see you.
Yeah.
Statue of Liberty, I have visited it. It is a massive structure. It is inspiring. As an English teacher, I especially love the poem that is on its pedestal. And the line that sticks out to me, and I added it in the blog post, was, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And that's exactly what public schools do. Come one, come all.
Yeah.
Come on. We take you all, no matter your financial status, no matter what your abilities are or aren't, come. We will meet you where you are and help you to have more options and opportunities in your life, which was also the promise of Ellis Island. Mm.
And Jackie, there's a great nods to the idea of public education in America here through Horace Mann and other people, Frederick Douglass. Tell me a little bit, Jackie, as you read through what Gina had written, what it brought up for you.
I really started thinking back to the origins of public education as I was reading Gina's blog. I'm not teaching it this semester, but I have taught in previous semesters an introduction to education class. And one of the things I watched in preparation for teaching that class was actually a PBS documentary called The Story of American Public Education. It was a mini TV series back in the early 2000s. Mm. And it walked through how we even began. You know, like the idea that public education hasn't always been, right?
Yeah.
It really is a relatively new idea, and it was a quintessentially American idea. And so paralleling it with the poem of the Statue of Liberty made me re-remember the history of public education. And just that it's not something to be taken for granted. You know, it really is something that we had to work for, that we had to discuss, that people protested, that people fought for who should have it and who shouldn't, you know? And so I think, similar to democracy, it is precious, and it is something that we must continually assert as something that we want as part of our society.
Here's a line from Gina's piece where she quotes Justice Thurgood Marshall, unless our children begin to learn together, there is little hope that our people will ever learn to live together.
Thomas Jefferson is one of the forerunners when it comes to public education, and he wanted it to open it up beyond just the wealthy people in the nation. And he said that public education is essential for a democracy to happen. Hmm. Public education is essential for this nation to do what this nation wants to do. And I think Thurgood Marshall's words, which came after a 1974 Supreme Court case about busing, I think his words also say, like, if we're going to be united as a nation, mm-hmm. United States, then we've got to have the public come together in our schools, learn, become an educated populace who can contribute to this country as well.
Yeah. The consistency with which people show up in an educational setting is also part of what you're honoring here. You're not in somebody's life for a brief period of time. You are in somebody's life day after day after day for a brief period of time of their childhood as they grow. So both those things are true at the same time.
True.
The stability and then the fleeting nature of, I had that student in class for 1 year, one semester, mm-hmm. 1 week before they went to another school.
Mm-hmm. But usually it's a whole year, and every day kids can count on us. We'll be there. We're going to do what we say we do. We're going to have routines. And even when their worlds are in turmoil, it could be the dog died, you know?
Right.
It's whatever. We're going to be there for them still. The secretary will still be there, and she'll smile when they arrive. And the custodian will still be there, and everything will be clean and wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, school nurse will be there with the ice pack.
With the ice pack.
You might laugh at the ice pack, but the school nurse will be there with the ice pack.
That's her number one remedy. Yes.
Jackie, what do you think about the consistency, the consistent presence? And when you're teaching the future teachers of South Dakota, do you talk about that openly, the consistent presence that you have?
Oh, absolutely.
Ma'am.
Yes, consistency is one of the best practices in education, right? Like, that is one of the ways in which you develop strong classroom management. That is one of the ways in which your students can begin to trust you, right? Is that you are consistently showing up in a relatively similar manner each day, and that you create a sense of repetition and storytelling and a net of safety. That's part of the hallmark of being a good teacher, showing up with consistency. But then I also, and maybe I'm just feeling particularly historical today, I feel like that's one of the promises of public education from its very roots. You know, Horace Mann, when he went around traveling to see all the different ways states were doing public education, he said we need to develop consistency across the nation in order for us to have an equal promise, so that it can be the great equalizer that we would like for it to be, so that no matter who you are, what kind of family you come from, how much money you have, no matter what state you're living in, you have the consistent promise that we will teach you to read and write and learn arithmetic, right? And that if you go through public education in America, there's a consistent understanding of the knowledge that will be imparted to you.
Yeah. That's Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. There's more to the conversation, of course. You can listen to Teacher Talk on your favorite podcast platform, or find it at sdpb.org/teachertalk. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngman. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you for listening.